Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Tobias Rötli, author of The Behavioral Economics of Inflation Expectations, Macroeconomics Meets Psychology, published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. Inflation expectations, their formation, their predictive accuracy, and their effects on business price setting and household consumption remain one of the great puzzles in macroeconomics. And as inflation returns to the developed world after a decade-long abeyance, understanding them matters more than ever. In this book, Professor Rötli has brought two relatively new disciplines to bear on the study of expectations. In fact, these are tailor-made for the task, behavioral and experimental economics. Tobias Rötli has been Professor of Macroeconomics at the University of Erfurt since 2000. A graduate of the University of Bern, he has worked at the Swiss National Bank, and been a visiting scholar at Harvard, Stanford, and the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. He is the author of three other books and a string of papers, the latest of which is the intriguingly titled 1 plus 1 equals 2, More or Less. Tobias, welcome to the podcast.
Well, Tim, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Well, your book begins by taking the reader through the historical and theoretical background to your research. I'd like to begin by taking a similar step back and running through a few of the core concepts and history underpinning your work.
Okay, so, well, maybe, and it's usually a good starting point to talk a little bit about the history of the field, and particularly when we, particularly concerning the history of expectations theories in economics. I think a good starting point here is Irving Fisher, because in the 1920s, when economics turned more formal and the models developed became explicitly dynamic, people started to have to develop views about expectations. Well, dynamic models are clearly models in which time plays an explicit role. And in financial economics, and quickly in the developing field of macro as well, there was a need for thinking about humans. Well, for example, lenders and borrowers looked into the future. So Fisher, of course, had this notion of how nominal interest rates move with inflation, because, well, for one thing, lenders want to be compensated for the loss in purchasing power. Okay? So when Fisher was a statistical man as well, not only a theorist, that made him unique at the time. Today, this is like, I think, the standard mixture. He wanted to test his hypotheses, so he needed an explicit model of inflation expectations. And clearly, well, because clearly it's not actual or current. It's not a running inflation that agents interacting to determine the nominal interest rate rely on. It's instead, it's what they foresee for the future, for the course of the contract that they're agreeing on. Now, Fisher, had this notion that people weighed past inflation. Okay, past inflation rates, to form an idea about future inflation. This is clearly what we call extrapolation. Yes, and Fish's, now turning to his findings, which is intriguing, he was led to the conclusion, in modeling expectations, as I said, he came to the conclusion that the history of inflation rates that people rely on when forming expectations, that they go back decades, in fact, 20 or more years for the US and the UK. So clearly, and even to Fisher himself, this is a bit odd, okay, this very long lag. A further point that Fisher documented was that with all trying, he did not find what he thought he should find, but he did not find a one-to-one relationship between expected inflation and bond rates. He barely found an effect. And this is what even recent research for many other countries, the US and for other countries, has found. Okay, in particular, the strong form of the Fisher proposition, this idea of a one-to-one relationship, is typically not found. And I think this is a very strong, a severe problem and a challenge. Now, back to the history of the field. Now, there were some refinements to the standard model of extrapolative expectations after Fisher in the 1950s and 60s, but all this was essentially swept away with the arrival of rational expectations. Okay, when John Muth introduced his notion of rational expectations in the early 60s, this, say, over 15 years, it just became the dominant paradigm. To economists seeing behavior as steered by optimization, it seemed the only way to proceed. Okay, it seemed like a straightforward way to theorize. Now, you recall that rational expectations assumes that agents use all available relevant information and that they understand the connections between variables, just as well as theorists do. So it's clearly a radical hypothesis. Yet, although quickly rising to prominence in economics, there were reservations raised against rational expectations rather quickly. And these reservations came from people like Herbert Simon, people with an affinity to psychology. Okay? Given that information processing takes time and energy, okay, which we have limited amount of, human behavior is guided by heuristics, by simplifications. And, turning then to tests, okay, where did rational expectations go? Well, of course, it hit empirical tests. So both empirical analyses with survey data, okay, extensively done, and tests in the lab were mostly negative, largely negative to rational expectation. It just appears that, the Muthian notion, although radical and in many ways consistent, is a poor descriptive account of how humans form expectations. But, I mean, it's still rational expectation is still being used, and it was actively used, at the turn of the century. But I think the financial crisis of 2007 marked a turn away from expectations. Okay, more and more researchers, I think, first in financial economics, started to turn back to the notion of extrapolation. Well, on the idea that maybe the radical turn, Muth's radical turn, had thrown out the baby with the bathwater. So, clearly, that's not, that's undeniable, okay? Old-style extrapolative expectations had its problems, okay? One critical point was that it appeared to imply a long-term trade-off between inflation and unemployment. So that sat not well with theorists.
Why was that specifically with extrapolative expectations?
Well, because the sort of extrapolation that, in particularly, Kagan and Nerlof had, which are later versions of Irving Fisher's, they had infinite lags. Okay, so it took a really long time, essentially forever, okay, for expectations to adjust. So that's one of the reasons, and that clearly is at odds with what people, you know, believe. That many people even today believe there's short run real effects from monetary policy, but essentially the idea that there's really persistent, everlasting effects, even if they get small, that's too hard to swallow. Now, but even with these problems of extrapolation, okay, there's more and more, there were more and more findings from the side of psychology, experimental studies and economics, that is really the past, simply the past of a series that is what people rely on when they form their view about the future of this series, okay? I mean, that was tested again and again. So the question then really came to be, how does extrapolation really work? And, you know, here I propose it's basically pattern, okay? Patterns, the recognition and extrapolation of time series patterns are key to understanding, to a modern understanding of extrapolation.
Yeah, and you seem to have departed from other research programs in this field by establishing cognitive science the foundation of your study. Was that very new, or had other people done this before?
Well, I mean, ideas from psychology or information processing, you know, along the ways of Simon have been with economics for the last 50 years, but clearly, experimentation has been part of the study of expectations as well. But you know, it's very difficult to go a different way and start from different principles. So, indeed, that's what I chose to do. I think a way to look at this is to just say that rational expectations, okay, the standard version, is a top-down model of rationality. Okay, it starts with assumptions, and it comes from the top. Now, what I'm proposing here is a bottom-up model of rationality. Well, rationality of expectations. Well, and a bottom-up means we first study individual behavior in the lab, and then build up from that data. Okay. Well, I see one convincing way that maybe helps economists put these things into perspective, like this new pattern-based approach of expectations with Muth's rational expectations. And it's the scheme that Daniel Kahneman has proposed, which I find very helpful here. I mean, Kahneman talks about a system one and a system two of rationality, I think. You know that, his book, okay? And system one is automatic and fast, okay? And system two is analytic and slow, and clearly they're complementary. So my pattern-based expectations, okay, they represent the system one side, okay? This is what that's what I claim. This is what we use in everyday situations to form expectations, okay, including expectations. It's just the dominant force. It's the everyday mechanism. Now, you know, rational expectations of the Muthian form, I would put this on the system two, okay, thinking. So, say in times of very significant changes, I don't see them right now, but for example, at the end of a hyperinflation, okay, and there's a new government, there's a broad coalition that brings in ideas in terms of different fiscal and monetary policies. I mean, people might well have the incentive to analytically think through things. And so Thomas Sargent may be right, okay, that at these times, inflation expectations are not just extrapolative. It may be, you may affect people's thinking in stark situations like that. But again, I claim this is the rare exception. Okay, typically we don't use our time to do this sort of exercise. So
could you take us through the design and implementation of the experiment and that you basically operated to look into this and explain how this is different from previous work?
Okay, so well, let me just summarize this with some basic ideas. Okay. And maybe start with what we already know, what other people have found about extrapolation. So first of all, the evidence is clear today that humans just look at a few data points. Economists and psychologists have found that again and again. So if we turn to inflation expectations, so what, let's say 1 year ahead inflation expectations, is basically the last 3 or 4 years of data that people rely on when forming these expectations. So, Fish's notion with 20 or so years, that's clearly wrong. Okay, that's fundamentally wrong. Okay. So a second important point is that people rely on visual displays of data. Okay, we are just evolutionary wired to see and assess situations, patterns, shapes. Okay. It has high survival value. Okay, that's what we're hardwired to be able to do that fast, quickly, and most of the time, beneficially for us. Now, if we talk a bit about the laboratory procedures, here we just something that in presentations has come up in many seminars. That what we do is we just pay a flat fee. Okay, in many of the procedures we have a flat fee. Now this contrasts with much of what experimentalists, particularly in economics, do. Now there, people insist that subjects get paid for their performance. Okay, so forecast performance, that would be in my realm. So in my view, this is not the right way to go for. Well, because for one thing, expectations 1 year ahead can be checked against the actual outcome only in 1 year. Okay, this is clearly a very different, factual feedback from reality than experimentalists implement in the lab. Okay, but sure, you can measure how expectations change over time in the lab with instantaneous feedback. But I claim this is something entirely different from expectations in the wild. Okay, I'm not interested in that. Okay, now by contrast, or a complementary argument, by the procedures run here are really much closer to the survey of expectations run by many institutions around the world. Okay, like for example, the Michigan Survey of Consumers, None of these surveys pays respondents for their accuracy. Okay? Typically, there is no payment at all. Okay? But still, many in the field, theorists and policymakers, take the survey data of expectations seriously. Okay? And I think for good reasons.
In that respect, I mean, is this not similar to the contrast between expectation surveys done by market professionals who do have an incentive to get it right and just asking consumers, as you say, like in the Michigan survey? So one of them has an incentive to be right and the other can just give their opinion. Is that not a similar experiment between being paid and not being paid?
Well, I think that's a difficult question, because for one thing, I think if I recollect correctly, the predictive accuracy, say, of the Survey of Professional Forecasters is not better than the Michigan survey data. So, honestly, I think if you motivate people by you know, by being honest and interested in their views about the world. And if you get them enlisted to do something, they typically do something, you know, to the best of their knowledge. I mean, that's my world or human view in that respect. I mean, sometimes, you know, if I in seminars, I come back with the question. So you don't ask people for directions in when you come in a new city, because presumably they just tell you nonsense. Well, I don't agree. Sometimes people don't fully know their own city, but you know they try to be helpful. So
yeah. And as I said, you in the experiment, you to clarify to listeners, these were students with a background in economics you chose. And yeah, can you just take us through the number of people, the time that they had to devote to the experiment, and so on?
Well, I mean, a basic run of this experiment is done with about 50 student subjects, and they all they had a basic education in macro, so they know what a CPI is or a GDP and things like that. And we repeat these runs, so we have them with the same instructions, have done them at different times. In fact, I will come back to that. In fact, in different countries, it's now not with that inflation expectation, but with pattern-based expectations. And, well, years ago, I did a study with exactly the same setup, and we did it here in Germany and in Japan, where two countries that clearly have very different cultures and histories. And in terms of subjective expectations, okay, the mean of these answers for each pattern is just the same. So it appears that, you know, that may just be a psychological universal, you know, pattern extrapolation.
And were the Japanese similar in only looking back over, say, 4 years That's interesting.
There's one interesting quirk with the difference between the two. We had a question on what we call higher order expectations, where you ask people, what do you think the average of people here today, where do they see this, the course of events going? Okay. Now, these higher order expectations, of course, Keynes was a great fan of them. I've never tried quite eagerly to make use of them. But an interesting thing, if you look at the Japanese and the German data, we find differences there. Okay, so the Japanese think of themselves as more reserved, okay, as more conservative, but they're actually not. And the Germans think of themselves as extremer, where in fact they're just the same as the Japanese. So it's like the thinking about how the collective works that differs, but in terms of how the collective works, there's no difference. So I think that was, in fact, that led me on a long way of newer studies, where I'm now, you know, interested in cultural aspects of economics.
Mm. Well, I mean, we just touched on some of the results. What else did you learn from the outcome of the experiment?
Well, the first thing, well, maybe that's not the central, but it's interesting. Of course, you know, there's heterogeneity. People extrapolate patterns differently. So, in fact, well, what we do is we bring people into the lab. We show them a series, an encompassing set of stylized patterns, which are price level patterns, and we ask them for 1 year and 5 year ahead expectations. And well, of course, as I said, there's heterogeneity, so people do that differently. But you know, interestingly, that is also the basis for being able then to model heterogeneity of expectation. It's one of the outcomes. We can compute time series of heterogeneity of expectations. Okay. Now, if we look at the means, okay, let's say for each short pattern of the time series, Now, I think one of the key findings, you know, that's a key point to remember, is that there are really very stark differences between how people extrapolate patterns with a clearly with a clear trend in the series, okay, as opposed to patterns with a broken trend or even a plateau pattern, okay? So the older notion of extrapolation clearly is off the mark. In fact, well, we can't specify a linear model to track these experimental data. Okay? I think that's a key finding. And well, the effects that I just talked about, they're also present in the heterogeneity. Okay, so for example, in times of clearly trending prices, heterogeneity of expectation, that's not a big surprise, is lower than in times where, you know, with broken trends and things like that. And further, we also have a probabilistic version. Okay, there's a procedure where I elicit uncertainty of expectations, and that can be modeled as well. Now, well, maybe that's a further point that listeners might find interesting. Well, which goes back to what I said before. There's no effect of doing this in different times with different people. In fact, with different cultures. And just looking toward the next step of where this is being taken, this is really important because this makes the basis or provides the basis for using this lab data to quantify a model of expectations that can be used, basically everywhere, okay? For all countries, for all historical periods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you incorporated these results and your research program into a pattern-based theory of extrapolative expectations. Could you talk us through that, please?
Well, okay. I mean, that's a key part in the book. And what we do is we take the answers of our subjects to this comprehensive set of circumstances, and then we combine it with historical CPI data for any country. Now, clearly, how does this work? Well, first of all, it works on the assumption, okay, now making the step from the lab data to historical series of expectations. This stands on the fundament of assuming that people in other places and other times just function as our subjects function in the lab. Okay, so that's clearly the basic notion. Then we proceed by taking actual short sequences of the historical CPI for a given country, and fit the laboratory data onto this historical series. Okay. So for this purpose, we have to clarify at each step which of the stylized patterns, okay, with their expectations measured in the lab is actually relevant. Now, the answer here is that it's a weighted mixture of expectations where the answers to stylized patterns are weighted according to the similarity of the stylized patterns with the actual historical series. Okay, so that's what I call similarity matching. And I think it's quite well explained in the book. And there's one more important element when taking the lab data to historical data. We have to scale, okay, the lab data to actual steps in inflation. So in the lab, we have steps of inflation of plus minus 1% and 0%. But clearly out there, there are cases where, you know, inflation is higher or lower. So we have to scale the lab data. And, well, when this full procedure, two-step procedure is applied, we can calculate historical series for 1 year ahead and 5 year ahead expectations. And, you know, in addition, series, you know, similar series of heterogeneity and the uncertainty of inflation expectation. Let me just note that in contrast, maybe that's the right moment to say that again or emphasize again. We use the lab, but the lab is used here just to run a once-only survey under control conditions. So we do not test hypotheses in the lab. So that's a key difference to, you know, normal experimental economics. But then, of course, you know, we want to use these data and use the full-fledged inflation models to explain interesting things. So the test comes now. Okay, it comes when we put these time series of inflation expectation or inflation uncertainty into econometric specifications, where we know that inflation or its inflation expectations or its uncertainty should play an important role.
Hmm. Yeah. Have there been applications like that?
Well, there's a number. I mean, like half of the book is about all this. So let's just turn back to Fisher's, you know, make the connection to what we talked about at the beginning, Fisher's hypothesis regarding the relationship between expected inflation and interest rates. When we use the pattern-based inflation expectations model, we find much stronger support for this hypothesis than in earlier studies. And this applies to a set of different countries and time periods. So including for the U.S., where the findings have not been strong at all in many studies. And even if we look at the puzzling period between the Civil War and the First World War, where, you know, prices first declined and then increased. So it also applies to, there's a chapter on high inflation countries, okay? And it's a good model there for explaining the course of nominal rates there as well. And there's two chapters that cover separately five Asian and five African economies, and there's much more evidence in favor, and oftentimes for the strong version of the Fisher curve. So, you know, my proposition is, if done correctly, it appears really that the notion that interest rates move one to one with expected inflation has much more merit than many people came to believe. But maybe that brings us closer to the second point, talking about how inflation expectations affect inflation itself. Well, maybe that brings us to a discussion then of current policy issues, but maybe not. Talking about the Phillips curve, you know, clearly we know that, I mean, there's a few people, I think, in the field would deny that inflation expectations for one or another reason, okay, of course, the approaches differ here, has a key effect on the course of inflation itself. And here, the pattern-based expectations, again, when we implement it in these specifications, okay, these specifications fare better than with other measures of expectations. Okay. Now, if we want to turn to current inflation, well, maybe
I would like to. I'd like to talk about a couple of areas where your work applies directly to current policy or the current policy environment.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with inflation rising now, I think the surge in inflation from the perspective of this approach is likely to persist for some time. Okay, certainly from the side of inflation expectations, this is a time pattern in most countries that I've looked at where you would say, okay, inflation expectations are increasing. Okay, so I think this will take a few years to bring down. Now, how does all that relate to things that I think are important, like the older views, like the quantity theory of money. I think the Phillips curve is a key, is just one element in a modern view of the quantity theory, and maybe listeners would gain reading my working paper. To note that I don't have a working paper, it's called the 8.5 equations version of the quantity theory of money. Okay, it gives an account of how these things fit together.
I'll add a link to that on the blog post.
Oh, great. Mm. Well, while we come back to a few points on policy again, but let me right here say something about what this approach, this once only approach of doing a survey, it's an alternative to rational expectations of the Moosian type, but it's a clear contender. It's a challenger to surveys of expectations. Well, for one thing, you just do it once, okay? You take people to the lab, you do it once. And then with the model that goes with it, with the modeling steps, okay, we can compute inflation expectations for periods where there were no surveys. Okay, that's clearly, I think, a big gain. And, well, further, since it's a model, it's not just a measurement, okay, it can also be used for what-if like type scenarios, okay? We can simulate how pattern-based expectations would proceed under different policy scenarios.
Yeah. So you do discuss how these ideas can be applied to areas beyond inflation. Can you talk us through those?
Well, There's a chapter. Well, that was really important for me to investigate the context dependence of that type of pattern extrapolation. And one way to go is like we did all what I explained. We did that with real GDP again. Okay, so we have the data elicited. We have the models fitted for real GDP expectations. Again, for the mean, heterogeneity, and as well as uncertainty. And that type of income or aggregate income expectations are important or interesting because that data can inform discussions like why did the Great Recession last that long? And my take on it, looking at the data, is that by contrast to other analysts, my take on this is that it's really the mean of expectations and not uncertainty that has kept the recovery back for such a long time between, say, 2010 and 2014. But if you allow me to talk to policy implications. Okay, so let's focus again on inflation expectations because I think these are the more critical topic here. One implication where I depart from what many people see and believe is in terms of the notion whether inflation targeting has, major gains that go with them. So, for example, people believe that they have given supporting analysis, that inflation targeting helps to anchor long-term expectations. And the UK is often used here as evidence, and it's shown that long-term inflation expectations dropped strongly after the UK assumed inflation targeting, formal inflation targeting. Now, when I run with UK data, my inflation model, I can track that decline in 5 year ahead inflation expectations just as well. And it's just backward looking inflation. Inflation came down, not in a linear way. Again, a linear extrapolation model would not show that, but they came down because inflation itself came down. And the difference between the UK and the US, okay, in terms of how over that time, remember the US has had no such inflation target at the time. That difference between these two countries can be tracked by pattern-based expectations. The same basically negative verdict in my view holds for forward guidance. I think it's a dead end. Okay, I think facts, inflation facts speak, not words. If you want to keep inflation expectations low, you have to keep inflation low. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to say that because obviously forward guidance has been really central to the policy of several central banks, including particularly the European Central Bank over the last 10 years. You think it's been pretty ineffective?
I mean, the effective part of policy has been the setting of exceedingly low interest rates. And clearly, you can affect the stock market by saying this or that, okay? And you'd rather say things that do not induce perturbance on the stock market. But in terms of how inflation developed, I think it had little or no effect.
Interesting.
Well, maybe another point, though, looking more at the historical part, you know, so in the book, there's a computer example, real rates, real interest rates for different countries for the periods in the 1980s with disinflation, okay? And when we look at the real interest rate from the Bank of England in the Thatcher years, okay, the Bank of England as an average between 1980 and 84, it documents a real interest rate of 3.7%. Okay, now my measure shows 6.6%, and I think this makes much more plausible the contractionary impulse of monetary policy at the time. So,
yeah. So, just before we wind up, you identify three areas in which the data and concepts in this book can be used. Can you go through those?
Well, I mean, really, the easiest way to use the book is. The approach is that there's a number of countries and historical periods where I list expected inflation, okay, together with the heterogeneity of inflation. So, for example, due to great database of the Bank of England, there is a table showing short and long run inflation expectations going as far back as 1702. Okay. And similarly, there are a series of expected inflation for 10 major economies together with estimates of real rates of interest using this new procedure. And I think these data are rather promising, in particular for economic historians. Now, if you want to go one step further, you can use the lab data and the programs. They're all on the website of the publisher of Cambridge University Press to calculate your own estimates of expected inflation, current and past, for any country you would like. And these programs are not, you know, they're just Excel sheets. So this is really simple. You should be able to get going very quickly. And the final thing is, well, you could use the lab instructions if you don't believe in my data. You could use the lab instructions to run the elicitation procedures in different countries and with people of different backgrounds. Well, in fact, I hope to be doing some of this work over the next 2 years myself, investigating, for example, where the subjects and countries with explicit inflation targeting perform differently. Well, extrapolate differently. Well, I rather guess not, but I would like to see the data.
That's the subject for the next book, I guess.
Maybe.
Well, since this is a podcast about books, as is customary, I've asked my guest to recommend a couple, one from his field and one personal choice. So, Tobias, what have you chosen?
Well, I've been looking quite a bit, but in terms of economics, I would recommend the book of my main thesis advisor from Bern, Jörg Niehans. And I think it's already a bestseller, has been for years. It's his book, A History of Economic Theory, Classic Contributions, 1720 to 1980. So it doesn't cover the last 20 years, but for anyone looking for a course, concise and analytic treatment of the history of economics, I think this is really a great book. And the personal choice, again, I had difficulties choosing here, but I think for his ability to put things in word at the edge or at the edges of our experience, I would go with Raymond Carver, and rather for his collected stories, but his poems are just great.
Right. Interesting contrast. Today I've been talking to Tobias Ridley about his book, The Behavioral Economics of Inflation Expectations, published by Cambridge. Tobias, thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure, Tim. Thank you very much.